Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's the first day of August 2024. We apologize for the brief delay getting started this morning. Nothing to do with this case, just an administrative issue. We are ready for the first case, State of Minnesota versus Antonio Jones Jr. Each of the lawyers should state his or her name for the record before each leg of your argument. There is an audio recording of the arguments this morning, and we want to be sure each of the lawyers is identified. With that, we'll hear from counsel for State of Minnesota, the appellant in this case.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the appellant in this pretrial appeal, the State of Minnesota. Right out of the gate, I plan to address 4 points about this appeal, and then, of course, I'm more than happy to try to answer any questions that this panel has. First, I want to be clear that the state is seeking either a saliva sample or a blood draw from respondent, but not both. I cite some of the case law in my briefing in this case, such as Maryland v. King, State v. Johnson, and State v. Bartilla, that indicates that a saliva sample, which is taken during what is often referred to as a buccal swab, is a less intrusive search procedure than a blood draw. Just wanted to be clear about that. Second, I want to address the precedential decision in State v. Steeprock that this court issued 3 days ago. As a threshold matter, Steeprock established a brand new rule, and the state has some significant concerns about the analysis in that opinion, but I do understand, as a precedential decision, that it is binding on this court and this panel as of Monday. There is a critical difference between Steeprock and this case, and that's that here, law enforcement did obtain a search warrant for a biological sample from respondent. However, when the respondent refused to comply with that search warrant, that is when the state moved under Rule 902 for an order from the district court, because to the respondent, that search warrant was not enough. And the record does establish that. I'd point this court to 2 different things in the record, unless, Judge Larkin, you have a question about that.
Is it that obvious? Why didn't you get a search warrant that could be executed with force? I mean, my understanding, we had years of DWI litigation, and the argument was like, well, do you want us to strap people down and take blood by force? I mean, I'm not understanding why the route wasn't simply a warrant authorizing the use of force. I mean, officers kick down doors, use all kinds of force to execute search warrants. Why not? Why go into Rule 9 here?
I think Rule 9, ever since State v. Dye, which I cited in my reply brief, 1983 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, has preferred that once a case is charged, that's the principle that's been extracted from it, Rule 9 is the preferred procedure. They did get a search warrant, as happened to be in this particular case, and I don't want to speak beyond the record. The search warrant is in existence. There's many references to it that I can point this court to, but the search warrant itself and the search warrant affidavit itself are not in the record in terms of whether or not the warrant actually did authorize the use of force.
Is there any law that prevents the state from obtaining a search warrant at this point, asking that the sample be obtained through the use of force if necessary, reasonable force if necessary?
I am not aware of one. A statute that I cite in my reply brief, 609.06, subdivision 1, clause 1, 3I, talks specifically about the use of reasonable force when carrying out a court order. I think it's a strong argument, although I don't find any clear, plain case law saying that a search warrant is equivalent to a court order. But in this particular case, the December 4th court order, which was under Rule 902, which specifically authorized a buccal swab from the respondent, is a court order, and read in conjunction with that statute, it would clearly authorize what essentially the district court backtracked on when they issued their March 1st, 2024 order, saying that you could not use reasonable force to get that buccal swab. Just so the record is clear, the December 4th, 2023 hearing, I can read it, but I just want to point this court to page 5, and that's where the prosecutor specifically details the fact that there was a search warrant that was issued. The defendant refused to comply, resisted that search warrant, which is why, again, going back to that principle extracted from State v. Dye, I believe the state went the 902 route and tried to get that order, because at that point this case had been charged and the respondent was represented by counsel. Then 2.5 months later, as this issue begins to be more litigated, litigated in the district court at the February 21st, 2024 hearing. It's now actually Respondent's Counsel, Ms. Cozio, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, I apologize if I'm not, who specifically says, with that in mind, turning to the court's order for a buckle swab, it's a lawful order. I understand that the court has the ability to make this order under Rule 9 and that the state did seek the buckle swab through the proper channel. Initially, it was a warrant request. That was not proper. Then it turned to a Rule 9 request. That ends the quote from Respondent's Counsel. And I think what Respondent's Counsel was getting at when it was back in district court was taking the very same position that was just saying, is that once a case has been charged and there is litigation pending, compared to the pre-charging phase of an investigation, the proper way to do it, which was, I think, widely understood until this past Monday, was through Rule 902.
Okay, well, now that you know what you know from past Monday, what should happen next? Are you asking us to say that under Rule 9, what? What do you want us to hold?
I mean, specifically in this case, I'm asking this court to hold that reasonable force consistent with Minnesota Statute 609.06 can be used when obtaining a buckle swab under Rule 902. And what I mean by that is under Steep Rock, it's unclear, but one interpretation that I've heard discussed over the past couple days is that you need both a valid search warrant, but after the case is charged, because of the notice requirements that are baked into Rule 902, you also need to follow the Rule 902 procedure in addition to the valid signed search warrant. And so because of that, I would like the ruling from this court that reasonable force can be used, again, in conjunction with the legal authority I've cited, as well as the legal authority that is integrated into Rule 902 itself.
I'm just thinking it through. Mm-hmm. If this court has said you need a search warrant to get a blood
buckle
sample.
Buckle swab. Oh, okay.
Steep Rock.
That was saliva sample specifically.
Saliva sample. You need a search warrant. Rule 9 is unconstitutional to the extent it suggests you don't need a search warrant. So why would we be using Rule 9 going forward? That's what I'm struggling with. Why don't you just get a search warrant? Why do we need this? Well, you need a search warrant and a Rule 9 order. The problem with Rule 9 is that it doesn't require application of the probable cause standard to conduct a search, which is constitutionally required. I'm just, from a practical perspective, I don't understand why anybody would proceed under Rule 9 going forward.
Judge Larkin, you have plenty of district court experience, both as an advocate and as a judge, and I very much respect that very practical question that we've been struggling with the last 72 hours. And I think one way of interpreting Steep Rock is it essentially eliminates Rule 902, Subdivision 2, Clause 1F, from really existing anymore, simply because of that ruling. However, the syllabus point of Steep Rock, which I don't have in front of me at this moment, but you can obviously pull up, I believe says a valid search warrant is necessary before a Rule 902 proceeding. So applying that syllabus point to the very real practical points you just raised, there's some incongruence there. And it seems that both processes may be required. I will admit that in the lengthy Steep Rock opinion, they are silent about that. They are also silent about that, again, that principle that I keep going back to State v. Dye for, which is that, you know, Rule 902, once a case has been charged, is the preferred process for obtaining any type of biological sample, whether it be a blood sample, whether it be a saliva sample from the defendant.
So maybe another way to interpret that syllabus point is, in order for Rule 9 to continue to apply constitutionally, any order issued under Rule 9 has to be pursuant to the process for obtaining a search warrant, an affidavit, judicial determination of probable cause, et cetera.
But there's another practical problem with that, obviously, is, you know, I mean, as the prosecutor, I do not go and get the search warrant. The search warrant affiant, the law enforcement detective typically.
It's harder to get a search. Well, it's more work to get a search warrant.
Well, it is more work to get a search warrant, but that is not even the point I'm driving at right now. I mean, you have your search warrant, right? And that you it's you know, obtained, you know, ex parte between a law enforcement detective and the signing judge, and then you have that search warrant in effect. It's a valid search warrant at that point. Maybe includes that reasonable force language, maybe doesn't need to because of that other legal authority I've cited. And then you go to Rule 902, that motion that I believe is still required because Rule 902 was not, you know, explicitly wiped out by this court's decision on Monday. And then you have a different judge determining the standard under Rule 902 than the judge who determined, at least in Hennepin County, than the judge who signed the search warrant on probable cause.
I'm thinking back to my time in district court. I can remember a couple of trials where mid-trial the prosecutor says, "Surprise, we executed a warrant at your client's home last night and we found more child porn. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do about the case?" I mean, no one gave us notice that they were going to go execute a warrant. They went and got the warrant. We had no idea. You seem to be arguing about Rule 9 as if once the case starts, that's not allowed. You have to give the defendant notice of any warrant request related to the case.
I'm not specifically aware of those cases involving homes, but under the plain language of Rule 902 as it exists today for a search of a biological specimen of someone's saliva sample or someone's blood sample, notice needs to be provided to the defense. It says that right after the opening line of subdivision 2.
May I ask a question? It may not matter to your analysis, but was the search warrant pre-charging in this case?
I don't believe so.
It was post-charging.
Yes, because the case was charged on a warrant status, and I want to say it was August 2023, because of that CODIS hit, the National DNA Database. And then after it was charged as a warrant, and then the defendant was extradited, I believe, from Alabama up to Minnesota. And after that point is when there was the search warrant that was obtained.
So how does that fit in? Was that a mistake to do a search warrant to start with if the preferred post-charging route is Rule 9?
It may have been a mistake at the time. After Monday's decision, it does not appear that it was a mistake.
Okay, so the post or pre-charging seems not that relevant to the determination. It's that under Steep Rock. There needs to be a search warrant.
Steep Rock is silent about when that search warrant needs to be obtained.
But even your analysis that you should follow one route versus the other, I mean, a search warrant here was post-charging.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm almost certain. At the same time, the search warrant, again, is referenced in the record as existing. The date that it was obtained is not available in the record. So it'd be going on the record to say that definitively.
You might be reaching, you have 3 and 4 points, points 3 and 4, I think, still. So maybe I'll let you hear those because I have a question about, I guess, the reasonable force aspect of this.
Yes.
That you would like us to address. It seems like in your brief you're saying we should borrow from the Winston analysis for the reasonable force part of it, right? For that.
I was trying to provide an existing standard out there that fit approximately with the facts we have here.
And Winston looks at sort of the reasonableness of an intrusion, and you're saying you should also look at that for the reasonableness of a force when someone is resisting what would otherwise be, I suppose, a valid search warrant for blood or buccal swab, right?
Yes. I mean, just to put a finer point on that, State v. Brown, which is a 2019 Mississippi Supreme Court decision applying the three-factor Winston test, I mean, that was
to a much more intrusive search.
I completely agree.
Okay.
In that particular case, though, I believe, I mean, it was an amount of force because I do not believe that person consented in any way to that particular intrusion.
Right.
And so I think that the Winston factors have been applied in without the consent, use of reasonable force, sedation, you know, to extract what they needed to or what they thought they needed to from that particular individual's body.
Okay. So my question is both sort of analytically and also just pragmatically. If you have a warrant for blood or a buccal swab, and that's, you know, valid and there's not an issue with it. Now, person does not comply. So pragmatically, do they need, you know, another step? Do you have to go back as a state and seek a reasonable force authorization? But let's assume that you do. Isn't the question not just, I mean, if you apply Winston like you do in your brief, which is just looking again at the intrusiveness of the search, that's a different question from what's required for someone who resists. Like someone might have their own particular issues, like they are, you know, like have hemophilia or something like that would actually make something more dangerous for them, their health or safety, that kind of thing. How does that factual basis about the particular circumstances of the individual who's resisting factor into the Winston analysis, both in terms of timing and then also analytically? Because it seems like the Winston analysis for blood or buccal swab is pretty much going to be a thumbs up, right, for the reasonable force. Okay. Do you see my question?
Exactly. I think it's an excellent point, Judge Smith. And I think ultimately what happened in this case is after that initial resistance, in terms of the reason for the resistance, other than I believe the quote is civil rights, but from the respondent, was not really well documented in the record. But I believe law enforcement and the trial prosecutor were effectively looking for assurance from the district court judge that they could do this, which again, I feel was actually already, especially either after the search warrant or after that December 4th buccal swab order, was already allowed under Minnesota law, and then they went for the assurance, and the district court effectively changed its mind. But you drive at a really good point that I hit on in one of my footnotes in the reply brief, which is it's difficult to apply Winston. At this point, it's very hypothetical. And where you see Winston being applied, whether it's in Brown, whether it's Winston, Winston itself took from Schmerber, I believe, you had the actual particular facts, the circumstances, like the complaint of why there was resistance there, because it was after the search. I mean, this is not by any means. Judge Larkin, I see my time is up. May I finish answering this question? Thank you, Judge Larkin. You have the you don't have those particulars available because of this like hypothetical whether or not it would be reasonable. I mean, you will know whether or not it's reasonable because we'll have the specifics of what happened in terms of taking the saliva sample with a Q-tip from the cheek of respondent, and if one officer, if two officers had to be there, whether it was sedation, whether it was ultimately just like a 2 or 3 second, you know, intrusion into their mouth, or if it was something much more egregious than that. And you would have those facts later on after this buccal swab is taken, and then of course respondent would have the right to move to suppress as being unreasonable under the Winston analysis. And then you would have the facts, I think, in terms of like the degree of the intrusion, you know, of what actually happened, why the respondent was resisting, all of those specifics available to the court to make an informed decision.
May I just follow up with one question? So was it unnecessary belts and suspenders, or is it unnecessary belts and suspenders for the state ever to go back by either method, Rule 9 or a search warrant, to get authorization for reasonable force, to execute a warrant for blood or buccal?
I can definitely see us extracting that lesson from this particular case in terms of...
Say that to me again.
Sure. I can definitely see the lesson of this belt and suspenders approach going back to that assurance from the district court judge when the law, you know, already authorized, maybe the search warrant itself already authorized in terms of what it said, use of reasonable force, that particular means of obtaining the buccal swab, and then going back for that assurance from district court judge led to the litigation and that order that prevent us from going forward.
Does the state have to do that?
Does the state have to go back to the judge? I don't think we do.
Ever under, for these types of searches and
My argument will be going forward that we do not under like existing Minnesota authority. And I believe, you know, going forward after Seabrook, assuming it remains good law, I mean, obviously a petition review is going to be pending, but that, you know, search warrants include that, you know, reasonable force language when authorizing a buccal swab. I mean, that would be my recommendation. So I'm not sure what you mean by inherently.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to distinguish between what you do to be safe versus what's legally required, in your view, what your position is.
The best practices are both of the same. I mean,
best practice would be to say we request a warrant for this buccal swab to be obtained by reasonable force if necessary.
Right.
You don't have to. I'm trying to get to the legal analysis as I work through this case. You don't have to ask for that. You would say a warrant is sufficient to use reasonable force, and then later someone could challenge to move to suppress based on excessive force, unreasonable force used.
I believe so if we assume, for the purposes of that statement, that a search warrant is a court order. I understand it's signed by a judge and issued, but if we're talking about specifically a court order, again, under Minnesota Statute 609-06, which specifically references order, not warrant, then you'd have to wait to the order being issued under Rule 902. So that's the distinction I'm drawing there.
So the search warrant could be viewed as authorization. It's not ordering anybody to do anything. It's authorizing somebody to do something. So there is a...
Correct, which again would then, you know, create the need for Rule 902. Sorry for going way over time.
Any questions? No. You'll have time on rebuttal. And certainly important issues. Respondents' counsel can have a few more minutes if necessary, so there's equal time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Koziel. I represent respondent Antonio Jones. This court's binding and precedential decision in State versus Steep Rock makes plain that the type of Rule 9 order in this case was unconstitutional. I want to begin, Judge Larkin, by addressing your question. The presence of counsel is required in a specific case or controversy at a critical pretrial proceeding pursuant to due process. So in this case, we learned from Steep Rock that both the Rule 9 procedure and a search warrant was required for this to pass constitutional muster. The district court here correctly declined to allow additional physical force to enforce this request. Force necessarily is not justifiable as to an unconstitutional order because that order was void ab initio. This point renders the state's argument in this appeal that it was legally justified to seek additional force for an order that was not constitutional moot. I want to address a few specific things at the outset. The first was the state's claim that no warrant existed in Steep Rock. That is incorrect. A warrant for a buccal swab existed in Steep Rock. It expired. It's unclear in the opinion whether or not Mr. Steep Rock resisted the enforcement of that warrant. Nevertheless, an invalid warrant at one point issued in that case post-charging, and that still did not cure the constitutional defect in that case. Now, notwithstanding Steep Rock's control over this issue, the district court correctly forbid a warrantless, forcible blood draw or buccal swab of a mentally ill client who was decompensating in the jail. And Judge Smith, this is precisely tends to your question about whether the intrusion turns only on the type of force sought by the state or whether it also turns on the individual. And
I want to get there, but let's back up for a second. You talked about what happened in Steep Rock. Can you address the, maybe I missed it, but did you address the argument that there was a warrant here?
In the record, there is no discussion of that warrant, and I will address that in more specifics later on in my argument. But the procedural
discussion of a warrant.
No substantive discussion. The warrant was sought ex parte in this particular case below. It's referenced in the record, but the particulars of what was in that affidavit is not before this
right.
court.
Right, we don't have a record of the warrant.
Correct.
There was a search warrant that was issued, right?
Correct, and that's the identical procedural history to Steep Rock, that the warrant was not valid when the state sought a Rule 9.02 buccal swab from a client, and that buccal swab, we argue, was not supported by probable cause. But just jumping back for a moment to your question about whether or not the intrusion turns on the individual as well as the type of force used, our position is that it absolutely turns on the individual and that both Brown and Winston explicitly carve out the individual's unique circumstances as a factor that may even be an exclusive factor. So in this case, the law is what's challenged. Judge Quam's factual findings are not at issue. And those factual findings in the record were a client with a complex history of commitment and mental health issues. Multiple appearances where Mr. Jones appeared while in custody in both ankle shackles and handcuffs. A record rife with outbursts and interruptions from a person laboring under active symptoms of mental illness. Ongoing concern for Mr. Jones and the deputies who were tasked with bringing him to and from court. Judge Quam's statement, which we've both made use of in our briefs, about his concern that a deputy could lose an eye trying to hold this individual down, and that this forcible intrusion that the state sought did not outline how it was to be performed.
Do we need to reach that in your view if the, I mean, your first issue is without a threshold search warrant. If we didn't think there's a search warrant here. Without that, just end of story, right?
Correct.
I mean, you don't get to whether the reasonable force decision was justified or not under Winston. Is that correct?
It is, because the order under Rule 9 didn't have the minimum predicate required by due process. The most basic procedural requirement of this type of intrusion is a valid warrant. And that's the clearest holding that we can take from Steep Rock, and it neatly applies here. I'd point you to the appellant's reply brief on page 13, where they conclude that there is no dispute here that the state is seeking Mr. Jones' DNA to aid in determining his involvement in this burglary. That is precisely the type of intrusion for this specific type of purpose that Steep Rock forecloses without a warrant. Now, there is
why do you go to due process analytically? Explain to me that part of your brief. It seemed to add a different test, right? The unconscious shocks of conscience and narrowly tailored on top of Winston's factors of balancing essentially the interests of the individual against the state interests.
Yes.
What case law should add the due process analysis?
The case law outlined in my brief specifically refers to whether or not a unlawful search or seizure, which I don't believe it's in dispute that a bodily intrusion is a search and seizure. The right to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure is a substantive due process right. That introduces the analysis for whether or not a compelling government interest is sought in a narrowly tailored manner, which answers, I believe it was a question both from you, Judge Smith, and Judge Larkin, about whether or not force is implicitly authorized in a search warrant under Rule 9.02 for a buckle swab. We submit it is not, because that is not narrowly tailored to establish a compelling government interest. The reason why the particular circumstances of Mr. Jones in this case illustrate why that must be so. Though there are some defendants who it is simple, painless, and easy to even get a blood draw at a hospital or a buckle swab in a jail. That is not this client, and that is not this case. And that's because of his unique particular circumstances and his unique vulnerabilities. That has to play a role in this. The fact that a buckle swab could be voluntary in most cases versus a buckle swab here, which could take several armed individuals wrestling with a mentally ill person decompensating in the jail, makes a difference.
What if it were hair? What if there was a 902 order to provide a hair sample? Walk me through what happens then. Is that a search?
Yes.
Hair. B, is a warrant required first before going under 902?
Yes. Pulling hair out of someone's head, I would argue, is still a bodily intrusion.
Okay. And then three, if the person resists hair, in your argument, the law enforcement would have to go back and get a search warrant. The state would have to get a search warrant to authorize force to obtain hair sample.
Let me back that up one second, because I think that the procedural route from the outset should be the investigator is seeking a warrant via affidavit with specific facts establishing probable cause. A Rule 9 order by the prosecutor should be sought that alerts counsel in a particular case or controversy about the existence of that warrant. And just like in a forcible entry to a home, if there are circumstances that justify that use of force, that should be included in the affidavit. There are specific arguments in affidavits all the time about why a no-knock search may be justified, why particular force may be justified, what particular risks to law enforcement executing such a search may be pertinent to an address. There is no difference in what's required in this affidavit in a bodily intrusion than in the intrusion of a home. And I would argue that a bodily intrusion requires even more caution because of the types of risks that it, the safety risks it inherently presents.
A couple of questions. Is my recollection correct? The case law says when analyzing the constitutionality of a search, you have to determine whether the warrant was reasonable in terms of its issuance and in terms of its execution.
Correct.
So there is always the possibility that someone could argue, well, yes, there was probable cause, but this warrant's execution was unreasonable under the Constitution, therefore the result should be suppressed. If that's the case, that suggests an after-the-fact review of what happened. What law says that there is an ability for the state to obtain permission to use a certain amount of force before it seeks execution? I mean, we have no-knock warrants and we have nighttime warrants. Is there any case law that the state would rely on? I mean, if someone came to me as a judge and said, I want this bodily sample, I want permission to use reasonable force, I would say, well, what's my legal authority to grant you permission to use reasonable force? What's the legal authority?
And I think I'm answering this question more from a practical standpoint than relying on a specific case, and that's the warrants that I see every day in my practice. If they are seeking a particular authorization, there are specific grounds for why that exists. And it's a I think it's a probable cause analysis.
The judge has to, I mean, if the law is you can challenge a search warrant, the execution of a search warrant as being unconstitutional because it was unreasonably executed, you know, that happens after the fact. What law says the judge can set parameters before the fact in issuing the search warrant?
And I would just go back to the constitutional requirements of warrants, that they must be particular, that anything that a law enforcement agency seeks in a warrant must be particularized to the circumstances leading to probable cause.
But that particularity requirement, doesn't that apply to the areas to be searched and what you're searching for?
It does, but if we're talking about the seizure from an individual, the areas to be searched is that individual. So the circumstances of the individual are necessarily included.
So am I understanding your answer to be, well, we really don't have case law saying, you know, here is when and why a judge can authorize a particular use of force when granting a search warrant?
I'm not aware of a specific case that answers that question.
Okay.
It's not in dispute that that force may be authorized. The United States Supreme Court frequently upholds warrants of execution. So there's no doubt that the government has the authority to use force. The question is, does the use of force line up with the circumstances underlying its authorization and the individual to be intruded upon?
But again, that's decided after the execution based on how it was executed.
And I think the logical misstep that we're having here is the reality that in a search of a home, the case only happens after the search of the home is complete, mm-hmm. right? Here, it's a different procedural posture because we're talking about a warrant that counsel has notice of. That is different than the search of a client's home you mentioned.
The search warrant for a home doesn't say, and you may kick in the door if they won't open the door. I mean, that's generally not spelled out in the warrant. And I mean, I think the law is you have no right to resist execution of a warrant, even if it's an illegal warrant. Your
yes.
remedy is to later complain via criminal case, suppression of the evidence, or a civil case.
Correct. And because I'm running short on time, I do have a point that's pertinent to this question I want to be sure that I make well.
Please do.
Which is
and
that
you'll have a few more minutes, as I said.
With the concern that Mr. Jones was resisting, which I will note, his resistance is not detailed in the record. It's a conclusory statement that he is not complying, and the extrapolation based on his presentation in court that he's resisting. But there's no detail about what the specifics of his actual resistance were. To the extent that there's a concern that his behavior authorizes resistance in other cases, I want to point to what Judge Quam actually did when he believed that Mr. Jones was not complying with a valid court order at that time. Judge Quam told Mr. Jones, you can either get out of custody or comply with this buckle swap, meaning that he was enduring additional days of custody in the circumstances I've described because of his noncompliance. When he continued to not comply, Judge Quam said, I am going to fashion a remedy that holds you in contempt. And that remedy was extremely unique.
Okay. I'm going to stop you because the problem I'm having is that we seem so far afield from what we need to decide in this case. I mean, right now we have a decision from this court saying you need a search warrant. You can't go under Rule 9. We didn't have a search warrant here. Why isn't that the end of the case? Now, I understand there are all sorts of other issues that arise, but that all depends on what happens, what may or may not happen in the future. Who knows? Maybe they get a warrant. Maybe your client cooperates with it. It seems like you're asking this court to write a lot of new law when it's completely unnecessary for us to do so.
I think that this court should order that force was not authorized in an order that was not lawful from its inception. But to that point, similarly to Steep Rock,
we simply argue there was no warrant here. There could be no collection. The end. So the state is sort of back at ground zero in terms of, you know, it has to make decisions about how to proceed.
That's right, but the difference between, I'm not asking this court to go beyond a ruling that upholds Judge Quam's decision not to use force and is consistent with Steep Rock's holding. But Steep Rock also turned on the premise that the record did not support a determination of probable cause. The same is true here.
And if I may, I think for the probable cause, it's clear, are including sort of a Winston analysis of the use of force, like at from the start, right? That as the state gets a search warrant for blood or a buccal swab, they better also include in there, if they intend to use force to execute it, they better include in there information about this particular person, and do they have like a particular dignitary interest because of their, you know, own circumstances, stuff that the state frankly might not know yet until they try and execute. You seem to be importing into the initial search warrant as a requirement of it being valid information that would measure the execution, you know, the execution of it. Am I wrong about that, or?
I don't want to call you wrong the first time I meet you, Judge Smith.
Am I wrong about what you're asking for?
Yes. Okay. And the reason is that force is not required in 99.9% of these types of collections. So in 99.9% of these executed buccal swabs, that won't be necessary. We're not asking for police officers to learn the intricacies of Winston and Brown and outline a three-factor test in their affidavits. No. But in this specific case where a law enforcement officer or a prosecutor is saying that jail deputies should hold an individual down with as many people as is required.
If the person resists, they have to go back and do something again. That's your view. Because they don't know going in whether the person's going to
say they're in this case where the prosecution believed when it sought the Rule 9 order the morning of trial, if, like in this case, they believe that there is going to be a reason to use force, that should be part of the initial request. And that should be part of its factual predicate for that request.
The initial request under Rule 9.
Yes.
Not the initial search warrant, the one that is not in the record.
Right.
Okay. And then it's your view that Rule 9 must be used. They couldn't go back for two, you execute search warrants here, that Rule 9 must be used, or
yes,
it's a good idea to use it?
That it must be used if it is seeking a sample pertinent to a case that already exists where counsel is represented. And that is not in Steep Rock, but that is the principle in State versus Dye. That is why I made the statement in the district court that it was proper for the state to seek this with the presence of counsel involved.
Can I ask one more question? So we'll take a situation, you get an initial warrant, we'll just assume that we recognize that here, initial warrant for blood or buccal swab, person resists. Can the state then wants to, it's person's charged, before or after, but they're charged. The state needs to use Rule 9 in order to then execute that, or to actually accomplish by force, or do they have to go and then in that process submit the information and make the record that would satisfy Winston, or do they go back and get another search warrant while they're also doing Rule 9? I'm trying to follow what the process is that you think is legally required.
Well, we know from Brown that a warrant is the bare minimum before we even get to the Winston.
I said we had a warrant to start with.
Right.
Okay.
So the warrant has to be, you know, just practically speaking, the warrant still has to be valid when the execution, the subsequent execution that may require force happens. It's very likely or probable that a new warrant may be required anyway for it to be
because
fresh.
Of the 10-day issue, is that what you're referring to?
Right.
Okay, well,
so
we have that. Okay.
So I don't think that it's a particularly onerous, burdensome, or unusual requirement for law enforcement to get another warrant with additional particularized facts. So, yes.
They would go in and get a warrant on Winston.
Right.
Facts.
Right.
And then they would also have to do a Rule 9?
Yes.
At that same time, presumably? You would have different judges maybe doing a... What does Rule 9 add to the game at that point?
Mm-hmm. That fulfills the defendant's Sixth Amendment process requirements for the presence of counsel at a critical pretrial proceeding. And I think the distinction here is that if I'm representing a client at trial, and they execute a collateral search warrant that exposes him to a traditional criminal liability in other cases, that's fair game. I did not have to be notified to fulfill my client's due process right. But if it's in that case, if during that trial they go execute a search warrant and try to use that evidence in the case, which is exactly what happened here, seeking a Rule 9 buckle swab the morning of a speedy trial demand, then I have to be notified. And that has to happen to fulfill my client's due process rights.
But wouldn't that simply be something you challenge after the fact, saying this is a Sixth Amendment violation to suppress the results? This was a critical stage. Counsel had a right to be present. I don't know why we need Rule 9.
The language of Rule 9 bakes in a constitutionality requirement, so I don't think that it differs from this analysis. It bakes in all this analysis.
So
I agree that the
need Rule 9? And I'm just, from a practical perspective, if I'm the judge and you come to me and say, I want authority to use reasonable force, I would say, well, you've got it. The constitutional measure is reasonableness in granting and executing a warrant. And I would maybe be hard-pressed to make, you know, any sort of, well, here's what you can do and can't do prospectively, because I don't know what's going to happen when you execute the warrant. Just because somebody was resisting yesterday doesn't mean they're going to resist tomorrow. So I think a judge would be hesitant to sign off on some use of force that could cause harm or discomfort. I'm just having a hard time understanding how we set the parameters in advance of execution as opposed to evaluating what happened after execution under a reasonableness standard, which we often do.
Right, and that's the particular difficulty of this procedural posture, is that we aren't talking about suppression, we're talking about something that hasn't happened yet. So
right, but if they used, let's say, get a warrant, they use force to take the buccal swab, and then the court looks at the amount of force they used and said, this is constitutionally unreasonable given the circumstances at the time of execution. Why wouldn't the remedy be suppression?
If it happened already, it absolutely should be. In this case, because we're talking about whether or not the district court's order was correct in denying an authorization of use of force in these particular factual circumstances,
but
we aren't making that argument.
But why do we need to get to that, because we didn't have a warrant in the first place?
And that's where I bring the court to the due process right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, which requires that any intrusion be narrowly tailored to a specific compelling government interest. And this order...
I thought the due process standard for evaluating an allegedly unconstitutional search was conduct that shocks the conscience.
There's a two-part test. That is one test. We argue it fails that test as well. But either schema violates due process. We're saying that the...
What violates due process here? Rule 9?
No. The specific order sought by the state, which Judge Plum correctly forbid.
But if the state sought an order and the judge denied it, why are we reviewing that order?
This is a state's appeal. I think the order was correct. And because of Steep Rock, the basic procedural due process requirement of such a request is a warrant. And we know that didn't happen.
And here, I apologize. I'm not exactly clear what the state is asking for here, which was the reason for that question. I don't know if the state is asking us to say the district court was wrong, the district court should have granted a Rule 9 order authorizing force. I don't know how the state could ask for that, since we've said you can't go under Rule 9, you need to have a search warrant. That's why I'm having a hard time figuring out why we would do anything in this case except say it doesn't matter what the district court did under Rule 9, because we now know that you had to get a search warrant and you didn't have one. Go back and start over.
And we're saying that there is no opportunity to go back and start over because, like in Steep Rock, the record is deficient in determining probable cause.
But why can't the state simply seek a new warrant at this point?
Because probable cause is lacking. There is no dispute.
Okay, but we don't decide that. That's what the district court would have to decide.
And it's not in the record before this court.
Right. That's what I'm just trying to narrow the issue to the record before this court, the decision that was made, and I appreciate, again, this opens a can of worms, and people want to know what the ground rules are going forward, but we're not here to write the next chapter in Minnesota practice on how you apply Rule 9 in light of Steve Rock. We're here to review the decision that was made in light of this court's ruling on Monday.
And I'm asking for a very narrow ruling that this order was not justified without a warrant, and it was correct for Judge Quam to foreclose the use of force.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Marshall, could you restart the clock? Thank you.
I'll try to be quick. I think what's difficult about this case, Judge Larkin, is that the state made its requests in initiating the appeal and briefing it, obviously, before the advice of this court in its, or I should say, controlling principles of this court on Monday. And I think to directly get to one of the questions that you asked Respondent's Counsel, whether or not a search warrant exists in this case is a dispositive threshold decision. The state's position, hear me out, is that the record establishes that there was a search warrant and it was valid. I understand the point that Respondent's Counsel made in her brief about Minnesota Statute 626.15, about not being executed within 10 days. And I understand that the search warrant was obtained, you know, in the fall and the, you know.
Can I just ask for a point of clarification? The decision you're asking for us to review and reverse is the district court's decision refusing to authorize the use of force under Rule 9.
The five-page March 1st, 2024 written order, correct.
But isn't that order immaterial now that we know a search warrant was required?
I wouldn't say it's immaterial under this, my view, the state's position, that there was a valid search warrant in this case earlier in the life of this case. I understand this court may not agree with that. I can read the room. And so if that is the decision of this court, then what I would encourage this court to do is to quickly cut an order opinion remanding the case back to district court, dismissing the state's pretrial appeal, I guess, as part of that remand, and saying, in light of the new controlling principle announced, you know, this past Monday in Steep Rock, we are remanding this case for further proceedings consistent with Steep Rock.
Can I ask you? I'm not sure what the room is. I think there's a lot of questions about that, so that's why I'm smiling. I don't know what the room feels, but can you respond to the idea that the search warrant doesn't exist here because it was more than 10 days old under that statute? Like, what is that valid search warrant? Address that. You have a difference of opinion about, let's even assume it was in the record for us.
Well, then we're starting to litigate what exactly a valid search warrant means. It was
correct.
A search warrant that was, you know, presumably, you know, supported by probable cause, signed by a judicial officer, and that was not litigated in this case simply because Steep Rock and that requirement did not exist. Everyone agreed there had been a search warrant in the fall of 2023 in this case for respondents, DNA sample that was not complied with by a respondent, and law enforcement encountered resistance, and rather than using reasonable force at that time, they chose to proceed with the state under Rule 902. So to respond directly to your question, Judge Smith, about 10 days, I think the search warrant was valid when it was issued, and I guess I will stand by that. It obviously was not and has never been executed, so it has not been returned in that sense.
And it's not the subject of the order that's before us.
Correct. I mean,
important under Steep Rock. You would distinguish Steep Rock by saying Steep Rock, the state moved away from its warrant. I think Steep Rock says the state doesn't rely on that warrant in any way. I think maybe a co-defendant had challenged it or something like that. But, right? Something. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But
you're spot on.
Okay, the warrant was say, so off the table, this is just plain old Rule 9. And you're saying here, though, like apropos of what we should be doing, is that that requirement was satisfied here.
I believe it was.
The threshold was met.
I believe
and
it was.
And it doesn't need, in your view, to all take place within 10 days, an unchallenged or at least a warrant that has not found to be invalid once issued, based presumably on probable cause, is sufficient under Steep Rock, and we have that here.
Yes, I mean, part of a problem that illustrates why that's the state's position. So let's talk about the 10-day rule one more time. And so you have a warrant that is signed, you know, supported by probable cause and an affidavit that's signed. It has to be executed under 626.115 within 10 days. But now you also have this additional requirement, as I'm hearing, to proceed under a Rule 902 procedure after you get that valid search warrant. The availability of counsel, the availability of, you know, respondents' counsel, you know, all of a sudden you're past that 10 days, you can't get to, you know, the actual Rule 902 motion hearing and order within those 10 days, and then all of a sudden that search warrant was obtained more than 10 days ago, can't be executed under 626.15. So I think that illustrates part of the problem and why that 10-day rule should not apply here. I do want to go ahead.
Part of the problem with grafting Rule 9 onto the execution of a valid search warrant.
You're preaching to the choir, Judge Larkin. I'm out of time. Can I make one last point that addresses what you said, Judge Larkin, before and over the course of the argument? And that's, yes, the state in this appeal, again, which was fully briefed before Steep Rock, is challenging that March 1st, 2024 order. Five-page order. The word warrant does not appear in that order at any point. It was very much focused on the buckle swab and the reasonableness of that. The term buckle swab appears 8 times in that order. And why Judge Qualm erred in this case in issuing that order is because he said reasonable force should not be used to obtain that buckle swab. And that directly contradicts Minnesota Statute 609.06, Subdivision 1, Clause 1, 3I. I can read it to this court, but given how long this argument is,
inconsistent with the constitutional standard of reasonableness.
Again, we're preaching to the choir. So with that, I would respectfully ask this court either to find the existence of a search warrant and proceed with the analysis as I just advanced, or to remand this case back to district court for further proceedings in light of Steep Rock if you feel that the record does not adequately establish the existence of a search warrant.
Any additional questions? Judge Smith?
No, thanks.
All right. Well, we thank you both. These are very difficult issues, uncharted territory. We appreciate that you want as many answers as you can get from this court, but we also are limited in our scope of review and what we're called to do in this case. So you will have our decision within the time allotted by law. That's one thing I'm sure of.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Well done.